This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a download from World War One at Home, a BBC and Imperial War Museums project all about people and places on the home front of the UK and Ireland during World War One. In this edition, Manchester's Baghdadi Jews and their fight to be recognised as friends of Britain. And Jim the dog, who helped keep the Kent coast safe. But first, we visit the site of what once was Craig Lockhart War Hospital in Edinburgh. Perhaps best known for its famous patients, the poets Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, who were treated there for shell shock. BBC Radio Scotland's Edie Stark discovered what had become of this pioneering hospital and how it contributed to modern-day psychiatry.
I've come into the old entrance to Edinburgh Napier University to see the War Poets Collection, which is housed here. The curator is Catherine Walker, who's with me now to meet me. It was here in 1917 that Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen famously met. Were they being treated by the same doctor?
No, not at all. Siegfried Sassoon had been sent here to be treated by Dr. William Rivers. Wilfred Owen, on the other hand, was sent here and was being treated by Dr. Arthur Brock. Arthur Brock's therapies were really the work cure, ergotherapy. He believed that men who were traumatised and shell-shocked had been disassociated in some way from their environment. So Brock's treatments really involved reconnecting the individual back to things that they were familiar with. Wilfred Owen, for example, was interested in words and poetry and writing, so he was editor of the Hydra, which was the magazine of the officers who were here. But he was also sent out to Tynecastle High School to teach English. So there was a plethora of societies and clubs and all sorts of things were going on in the building.
Ultimately, send them back to war.
Absolutely, that was the doctor's job.
The River Centre for Traumatic Stress is part of the Royal Edinburgh Hospital in Morningside. It's named after Captain William Rivers, who treated officers returning from the trenches in France at Craig Lockhart War Hospital.
The foundation of the way we treat people today is that you have to re-experience and relive your trauma in a safe and secure setting. And that's what he did. And the idea that if you can relive that in the present, that can help you come to terms with it, was pioneered by him. And no one else, I think, was doing that at that time.
Psychiatrist and psychotherapist and founder of the River Centre, Chris Freeman.
Looking at the notes that we have left from Craig Lockhart, even those people who got what you might call social therapy, you know, which would be fresh air, walks, exercise, good food, etc., nobody got physical therapies. Nobody got electric shocks, nobody got, you know, traumatic treatments. They all had a psychological approach, and I think it was pretty unique in that regard.
I see a photograph of Rivers up here, standing literally about four steps away from where I'm standing at the moment, and he's in his uniform. It was a military hospital. The doctors were presumably expected to be in uniform all the time, were they?
Yes, absolutely, and if you can see this photograph here of the staff and the patients.
Immaculate.
Absolutely immaculate, and you can note the shine on the boots and the fact that they do carry their canes and swagger sticks, and this was expected.
But I'm assuming that the common military view at that time was that shell shock sufferers could be malingerers, it could be an excuse for desertion.
Yes, constitutional weakness, yeah, that if these were better men and better bred, this wouldn't have happened to them. And of course, what was clearly demonstrated by Craig Lockhart was that there were officers there, you know, quite senior officers who broke down in just the same sort of way. And that idea that every man has his breaking point, no matter what his breeding, his background, came out from that.
Did the men get better?
Some got better. Some got better and were sent back to the theatre of war, wherever that may be, like Owen.
If I'd been here, I would have thought it was in my best interest not to show any signs of getting better.
No, Wilfred Owen says that in his introduction to the Hydra. In one copy, he says, many of us who came to the Hydra slightly ill are becoming dangerously well. And it was dangerously well. He went back to France and he was shot a week before the end of the war. His mother received the telegram when the armistice bells were ringing.
Craig Lockhart War Hospital in Edinburgh, where shell-shocked soldiers were treated. Next, to Manchester, where trade links with the cotton trade created a melting pot of different cultures in the city. But the outbreak of war meant these links were stretched and in some cases severed. When war was declared, a group of businessmen from the Ottoman Empire fought vociferously to be treated not as enemies of Britain, but as friends. While some Ottoman citizens were interned, others fought to remove tight restrictions on their travel, which were harming their businesses. BBC Radio Manchester's Jonathan Ali reports.
He was only allowed to move 5 miles radius. He couldn't move.
Essie Leon's father was from Baghdad, her mother from Egypt, and were still Ottoman citizens in 1914. Essie grew up in Didsbury and spoke to the Manchester Jewish Museum about the restrictions placed on her father.
Luckily, we were just 5 miles from town, so we could go to work, but that was all. I know our house was watched by police.
The Sephardic community tended to live in South Manchester and included Jews from around the Middle East and Balkans who'd come to Manchester for the textile trade. Some of the long-established families had taken British citizenship. Their sons rushed to the colours when war was declared on Germany in August 1914. But when the Ottoman Empire joined the war in November, it split the community, many of whom were still classed as Turkish citizens. Basil Judah is the community's historian.
You saw, therefore, the Sephardic community split in two between those who were anglicised, and some of them well-settled, prosperous, living in good houses, offspring had gone to good schools and so on and so forth. And then you got this other group, which was still speaking in Arabic and trading in Arabic and so on, who weren't British naturalised citizens, who, with the outbreak of war, they were then classified as alien enemies. And so they were subject to the variety of restrictions as immigrants. And they were described collectively as Turkish Jews. They may have come from Salonika in Greece, they may have come from Smyrna in Turkey, they may have come from Baghdad in Mesopotamia, they may have come from Beirut, Lebanon, or wherever, but they were all described as Turkish Jews, and as such they were subject to restrictions on what they could do. And some were actually interned for several years in the Isle of Man.
I remember hearing of other people having to register or the police coming to visit them. They were considered as enemy aliens.
Edward Shohet's parents were from Baghdad and Aleppo. He was 4 when war broke out.
People I knew quite well, one of whom was, I think, Mr. Shasha. Couldn't understand why the police came. And then even my own father, the police used to come round to the office every few months, and I'd get sent out of the room while they had a discussion. I never quite knew why. They were just checking up on him because he became British by naturalisation. He must have been, Baghdad in those days belonged to the Ottoman Empire, so he was an Ottoman subject. So he presumed he was an alien until he became British, and even then they checked up on him regularly.
The Ottoman merchants were now seen as enemies of the state and had tight restrictions placed on them, including a 5-mile limit on travel. As businessmen, they felt it stopped them trading, and in May 1915, 8 Baghdadi Jews and 5 from Aleppo petitioned the Home Office to have the restrictions relaxed. The Home Office refused. Basil Judah says it annoyed the group because other Ottoman subjects did have their restrictions lifted.
What was galling was that other parts of the Ottoman Empire, where people had come from, Greece and Armenia, and Christian communities were deemed to be more friendly to the United Kingdom. They didn't have these restrictions. And of course, the five from Aleppo merchants and eight merchants from Baghdad were really upset about the way they were being treated. But they were not given any exemption at all. And so they just had to continue. And one or two of them were interned in the Isle of Man. They felt inferior by dint of the restrictions to the Armenians, and they couldn't really take this idea that they were inferior to a group of a nation that they really did feel inferior to, rightly or wrongly. So they felt it humiliating, and also they were restricted in their trading activities.
The group was so determined to have the restrictions lifted that they appealed again to the Home Office in March 1917.
To the Right Honourable Sir George Cave, KCMP, His Majesty's Secretary of State for Home Affairs. The humble petition of the undersigned natives of Baghdad in Mesopotamia, members of the Jewish faith and dwellers and traders in or about the city of Manchester, showeth 1. Your petitioners, by reason of their birth in the Ottoman Empire in or near the city of Baghdad, are technically alien enemies of the British Empire. 2. Your petitioners are in fact loyal to the British Empire, where many of them have lived since childhood and hope to remain for the remainder of their lives. Many of them, in realising the aspirations of their race, may enjoy the free and benevolent rule which is accorded to the subjects and friends of the British Empire.
This time it was successful because the British had now conquered Baghdad, which meant restrictions were lifted for those who came from Mesopotamia and Syria, but it still meant some Jews from other parts of the Ottoman Empire weren't yet free. That freedom only came at the armistice in November 1918.
The story of Manchester's Baghdadi Jews. At the start of World War I, the greatest threat to the Kent coast was the Zeppelin. With its ability to fly high and cut its engines to a low drone, it created a need for vigilance in the air for the first time in British warfare. But on the cliffs at Birchington, a young Airedale terrier called Jim was ready to warn his master of the approaching danger. BBC Radio Kent's Joe Byrne has the story.
Hello, lad. Is it that time already? What is it you want? You want to go out?
One of the coast guards had a dog, and his name was Jim, and he was an Airedale.
So, what are we going to see out there tonight, eh? Is there going to be anything about? Hey, what are we going to see?
What must have happened in some way was that dog picked up the sound of something that it didn't recognise, and it worried the dog.
What have you seen, boy? Hey, what's up there?
Then the coast guard would have picked up the sound from the Zeppelin, and at that point he then realised what it was had started the dog's agitation in the first place.
Good lad, good lad. Well spotted. Good lad, good lad. You'll get your dinner tonight now.
All the evidence of Jim the dog's talent has vanished, except for a photo from the archives of the Imperial War Museum, which captures him standing alert and proud on a clifftop, which local historian Jenny Burgess has identified as Eppel Bay, on the coast of Birchington near Margate.
It was realised fairly early on that this new invention of flying was going to make an extra problem for the people down on the ground, because it meant that people could look down and could throw things at us, like bombs, etc.
Once the threat was spotted, the Coast Guard would inform the nearby Navy base at Westgate, which was later moved to Manston. Jim had alerted his master to a potential threat and would get his dinner as promised.
They have a natural guarding instinct, as most terriers will. Being the largest of the terriers, obviously, when they bark, they have quite a loud bark.
Brian Collins from Ashford has bred and shown Airedales for more than 20 years.
The Airedale was used along with other dogs, but the Airedale predominantly was used as a messenger. Would have a special message collar with a pouch. They would be used for running telephone cables, searching out for wounded, obviously sentry duty, carrying carrier pigeons, baskets of carrier pigeons, first aid duties, running supplies, all sorts of things.
So, Could Jim really have been the forerunner of the early warning systems, which went on to protect our Kent coastlines?
In later years, we probably more appreciate some of the things that dogs have done in the past. So the fact that this has come out about Jim, I think it's getting more recognition, and it's rightly so.
Airedale breeder Brian Collins ending that report from Joe Byrne and this podcast. If you want to find more fascinating World War One stories close to you, then you can search our website by postcode or place name. Just go to bbc.co.uk/WW1 and click on World War One at Home.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.